Welcome back to This Week in HRV, the show where we take the latest peer-reviewed research in autonomic science and make it genuinely useful for clinicians, researchers, coaches, and anyone who cares deeply about what the nervous system is telling us. I'm really glad you're here for this one, because today's episode covers four studies across four completely different clinical domains, and yet all four arrive at the same place: HRV as a window into how the autonomic nervous system functions, adapts, and communicates to stress or recovery. Before we get into anything, the standard but important reminder: everything you hear on this show is for educational and informational purposes only. None of it constitutes medical advice. Nothing here should be used to diagnose, treat, or manage any health condition. The research we discuss is interesting and sometimes clinically provocative, but that does not make it clinical guidance. If you have questions or concerns about your health, please work with a qualified clinician who understands your individual history, context, and goals. Today's four studies span acupuncture, exercise physiology, sleep medicine, and urology. They involve needles on specific anatomical points, treadmills in a university gymnasium, a chest-worn patch, an artificial intelligence algorithm, and a surgical resection of prostatic tissue. At first glance, they could not be more different, but the thread that runs through all four is the autonomic nervous system and its most practical quantitative marker, HRV. Here's the lineup. First, we are looking at a structured narrative review published in Curious that asks whether a curated cluster of traditional acupuncture points can be mapped onto measurable biomedical mechanisms, and particularly those involving autonomic modulation in HRV. Second, we are examining a pre-post interventional study that asked what happens to HRV in sedentary obese young adults when they use a treadmill at moderate intensity for 6 weeks. A third, and this is the study I'm most excited about from a technological standpoint, we are digging into a paper from Nature and Science of Sleep that combined a wearable patch type HRV analyzer with an artificial intelligence model to screen for obstructive sleep apnea. And fourth, we are examining an observational study that compared two standard treatments for benign prostatic hyperplasia, surgical resection, and alpha-blocking medication, and track the effects of each on HRV over 12 weeks. Let me start with a confession that I think most honest people working at the intersection of integrative and conventional medicine would share. Acupuncture is genuinely difficult to evaluate, not because the research doesn't exist — there's actually a substantial volume of it — but because the frameworks used to explain why acupuncture might work have historically been so misaligned with the frameworks that conventional medicine uses to evaluate any intervention that the two sides have often talked past each other entirely. On the traditional side, acupuncture is explained through concepts such as qi, meridians, and energetic flow, a system of physiological metaphors that was sophisticated and clinically generative in its original context, but does not map onto the vocabulary of receptors, signaling pathways, and neurotransmitters that contemporary biomedicine depends on. On the biomedical side, the response has often been to either dismiss acupuncture entirely as a placebo or to conduct trials that impose Western randomized controlled trial methodology onto a practice that doesn't always fit neatly into that design, and then to be surprised when the results are heterogeneous and hard to interpret. What has been missing, arguably, is a third approach, one that sets aside both traditional metaphysics and blanket skepticism, and instead asks empirically whether stimulating specific anatomical locations on the body produces measurable, reproducible, mechanistically coherent changes in physiological systems we actually care about. That is the approach this first study takes. This study was published in Curious and is titled Most Useful Acupuncture Points Teaching Cluster, a Structured Narrative Review of Mechanistic Evidence for Biomedical Acupuncture Training. The authors are Yingos Karavas and Miltiades Karavas. The starting premise is straightforward. If acupuncture is going to be integrated meaningfully into biomedical practice, rather than sitting alongside it as a parallel, largely disconnected tradition, then practitioners need a framework that makes sense in biomedical terms. That means moving away from meridian-based explanations and toward explanations grounded in neurophysiology, immunology, and autonomic science. It also means having some principled basis for selecting which points to use, rather than defaulting either to tradition alone or to the idiosyncratic preferences of individual practitioners. The authors propose a candidate cluster they call the most useful acupuncture points, 11 body points plus an auricular zone. The 11 body points are LI4, PC6, ST36, SP6, LR3, GV20, GV26, GB34, TW5, and CV6. The auricular zone is the auricular vagus zone, located on the ear at the distribution of the auricular branch of the vagus nerve. These designations come from traditional acupuncture nomenclature, but the authors are not asking us to accept the traditional explanations for why they work. They're asking whether there is sufficient mechanistic biomedical evidence, drawn from independent studies using contemporary physiological outcome measures, to justify studying and teaching these points within a biomedical framework. To answer that question, they conducted a structured narrative review. This is a design that sits between a traditional narrative review, which can be selective and idiosyncratic, and a full systematic review with quantitative synthesis. The authors searched PubMed and Google Scholar and used backward citation tracking to identify relevant literature. Studies were included if they examined at least one of the pre-specified candidate points and reported measurable physiological outcomes in one of several pre-specified domains: autonomic modulation, inflammatory signaling, neuroimmune pathways, brain gut reflexes, limbic or cortical activity, or HRV parameters. The inclusion criteria were explicit and applied prospectively, which distinguishes a structured narrative review from an unstructured one. 71 studies met those criteria and underwent what the authors describe as standardized mechanistic extraction. Now let's get into what they found, because the findings are genuinely interesting. Across several domains, an HRV sits at the center of the most consistent results. Starting with the autonomic findings, ST36 and PC6 emerged as the two points with the strongest and most consistently replicated evidence for vagal pathway engagement. ST36, located on the lower leg over the tibialis anterior muscle, roughly four finger widths below the knee, has been the subject of extensive research in the context of the vagal anti-inflammatory reflex. Multiple studies in the included set found that stimulation of ST36 increased high-frequency HRV, which is the frequency band most directly associated with parasympathetic modulation of the heart, and simultaneously suppressed sympathetic outflow markers. Several studies have pointed to cholinergic mechanisms, specifically activation of the efferent vagal pathway and subsequent release of acetylcholine at peripheral sites as the mediating pathway. PC6, located on the inner forearm, approximately 2.5 finger widths above the wrist crease, between the tendons of the flexor carpi radialis and palmaris longus, showed similar patterns. It has been studied most extensively in the context of nausea and cardiovascular modulation, and the included studies found consistent evidence of increases in high-frequency HRV and sympathetic suppression following stimulation. The anatomical proximity of PC6 to the median nerve and the density of neural elements in this region have led researchers to propose segmental spinal reflex mechanisms as a plausible pathway alongside supraspinal effects. On the inflammatory side, ST36, SP6, LI4, and GV20 were all associated with reductions in pro-inflammatory cytokines across multiple included studies. More specifically, the evidence pointed to modulation of nuclear factor kappa B, the master transcription factor for inflammatory gene expression, and the NOD-like receptor protein 3, NLRP3 inflammasome, a multi-protein intracellular complex involved in innate immune activation. The NOD-like receptor thermal protein domain-associated protein 3 inflammasome, when activated, drives the production of interleukin 1-beta and interleukin 18, two of the most potent pro-inflammatory cytokines in the innate immune repertoire. The idea that peripheral needle stimulation at specific anatomical locations can modulate these pathways is not as implausible as it might initially sound. There is a well-documented neural reflex arc, the inflammatory reflex, through which vagal efferent activity suppresses peripheral immune activation. ST36's repeated association with both vagal activation and anti-inflammatory signaling is consistent with this mechanism. GV20, located at the vertex of the skull, at the intersection of the midline, and a line connecting the apices of the ears, has been repeatedly reported in the cognitive and neuroprotective literature. Multiple included studies found that GV20 stimulation was associated with improvements in learning, memory, and neuroplasticity markers in animal models. The limbic and cortical findings, involving LI4, LR3, ST36, and GV20, pointed toward modulation of limbic-paralimbic networks, the anterior cingulate cortex, and the insula, structures deeply involved in pain processing, emotional regulation, and interoception. Some of these findings come from neuroimaging studies, which adds a layer of mechanistic credibility. You can see the brain responding. Now, I want to spend some time on the limitations, because they are genuinely important, and the authors address them honestly. First, the design. A structured narrative review, even with explicit inclusion criteria and standardized extraction, is not a systematic review and cannot support quantitative conclusions. The 71 included studies are heterogeneous in design, species, stimulation technique, needle depth, stimulation duration, and outcome measurement. Comparing an animal study using electroacupuncture at ST36 for 30 minutes with a human study using manual acupuncture at the same point for 5 minutes is not straightforward. Second, the mechanistic claims are plausible but not proven. Showing that ST36 stimulation is associated with increased high-frequency HRV across multiple studies is not the same as demonstrating that this effect is mediated by vagal efferent activation rather than general relaxation, expectation, effects, or nonspecific physiological arousal from the needling sensation itself. Third, the most useful acupuncture points cluster is explicitly described as a candidate cluster requiring prospective validation. The authors are not claiming this is the optimal set of points. They are claiming it is a mechanistically defensible starting point for a biomedical teaching curriculum and for future protocol development. That is a much more modest claim, and one the evidence supports. What this paper does well, and what I think makes it genuinely valuable regardless of where you sit on the acupuncture spectrum, is that it represents a serious, transparent effort to ask a mechanistic question about a practice that has too often been evaluated only at the level of clinical outcomes without adequate attention to the physiological pathways that might explain why it works when it does. The HRV signal in particular, the consistent finding that PC6 and ST36 engage vagal pathways and shift the autonomic balance toward parasympathetic dominance, is a thread worth pulling in future prospective research. For HRV practitioners specifically, this raises the intriguing possibility that peripheral needling at specific anatomical sites might be an underexplored intervention for shifting autonomic tone, warning rigorous investigation. Let's shift from needles to treadmills and from the language of neuroimmune reflexes to the more familiar territory of exercise physiology. The relationship between physical activity and cardiovascular health is among the most robust findings in medicine. What we understand less well, or at least what the mechanistic picture is still being filled in on, is the precise way in which exercise reshapes the autonomic nervous system, and whether HRV can serve as a sensitive and reliable marker of that reshaping as it happens in real time across a training program. That question becomes especially important and especially clinically actionable when you ask it in a population that carries a disproportionate burden of autonomic dysfunction. Obesity is one of the most important such populations. Excess adiposity is associated with chronic low-grade inflammation, insulin resistance, and sympathetic nervous system activation. Sympathetic overactivation, in turn, suppresses vagal tone, producing the characteristic HRV signature of obesity: reduced overall variability, lower high-frequency power, and an elevated low-frequency to high-frequency ratio, indicating sympathetic dominance. This pattern is detectable even in young, apparently healthy obese individuals who have not yet developed overt cardiovascular disease, which means HRV may be capturing early autonomic pathology before clinical endpoints appear. This study was published in the Journal of Dot Omega Institute of Medical Sciences University and is titled Heart Rate Variability Changes Following Treadmill Running in Sedentary Obese Individuals, a Pre-Post Interventional Study. The authors are Subhashankar Sahu, Shivani Patil, and M. Premkumar. The study recruited 41 sedentary obese adults between the ages of 17 and 25, all with a body mass index at or above 30 kilograms per meter squared at Srinivas University in Mangalore, India. The intervention was a 6-week treadmill running program consisting of 5 sessions per week, each lasting 45 minutes at moderate intensity. HRV was assessed at 4 time points: baseline, 5 days into the program, 15 days into the program, and 45 days into the program. This multi-point measurement design is useful because it provides insight into the trajectory of autonomic adaptation, not just whether things changed, but when they began changing. The HRV parameters assessed were the standard deviation of normal to normal intervals, standard deviation of normal to normal intervals, index, high frequency power, low frequency power, and very low frequency power. Heart rate and blood pressure were also tracked at each time point. The results were statistically significant across the board. All 5 HRV parameters improved from baseline to 45 days, with p-values less than 0.001 across all measures. The standard deviation of normal to normal intervals is a time domain measure of overall HRV. It captures the total variability in the intervals between consecutive heartbeats. A higher standard deviation of normal to normal intervals indicates the heart's timing is more variable, reflecting a nervous system that is more responsive and flexible in its regulation. An increase here suggests the autonomic nervous system became less rigid, that it gained the capacity to modulate heart rate more dynamically. The high-frequency power component is arguably the most clinically meaningful. High-frequency power, in the range of approximately 0.15 to 0.4 Hz, corresponds to the respiratory sinus arrhythmia, the beat-to-beat variation in heart rate driven by breathing. This component is parasympathetically mediated, meaning an increase in high-frequency power directly reflects enhanced vagal tone. In an obese, sedentary population where vagal suppression is the expected baseline, an increase in high-frequency power after a moderate exercise program is precisely the autonomic signal you would want to see. The heart rate findings deserve attention, too. The decrease in average and minimum resting heart rate is consistent with enhanced vagal tone, the classic cardiovascular adaptation to aerobic training. But the increase in peak heart rate during exercise is equally significant. It suggests improved chronotropic competence, the heart's ability to increase its rate appropriately in response to metabolic demand. In sedentary obese individuals, chronotropic incompetence is actually a recognized clinical problem and an independent predictor of cardiovascular risk. The improvement here suggests that the exercise program enhanced not only resting parasympathetic tone, but also the dynamic range of heart rate regulation. The drop in systolic blood pressure at 45 days, while diastolic blood pressure remained unchanged, is consistent with what we know about the blood pressure response to aerobic training. Systolic pressure tends to be more responsive to exercise intervention in the short term, when elevated sympathetic tone is a contributing factor. Now, the limitations. The most fundamental constraint of this study is the absence of a control group. This is a pre-post design, meaning every participant received the intervention, and measurements were taken before and after. Without a group of similar individuals who were measured at the same time points but did not undergo the exercise program, we cannot attribute the observed changes causally to the treadmill running. It is possible that some of the observed changes reflect seasonal variation in physical activity, regression to the mean, the Hawthorne effect, or simply the passage of time. The authors acknowledge this directly and call for randomized controlled trials, which is the appropriate response. The sample size of 41 is modest. It provides adequate statistical power to detect large effects as observed here, but it does not permit reliable subgroup analyses. The age range of 17 to 25 is an important contextual factor. The autonomic nervous system in young adults is generally more plastic than in middle-aged or older populations. The training-induced improvements observed here may not be as large, as fast, or as sustained in obese adults in their 40s or 50s. Finally, the absence of follow-up data beyond the 45-day endpoint means we have no information about durability. Does the autonomic benefit persist after training stops? Those questions are clinically critical and remain open. Within its limitations, this study contributes a temporally resolved picture of autonomic adaptation in a population often described in terms of risk rather than reversibility. The fact that measurable, statistically significant improvements in HRV appeared within 45 days of a practical exercise program is clinically encouraging. It frames exercise not just as a caloric intervention, but as an autonomic rehabilitation tool. And that framing has real implications for how we communicate with patients and how we measure success beyond the scale. This episode is brought to you by Optimal HRV, the platform built from the ground up for HRV monitoring, interpretation, and coaching. If you're a clinician trying to track your patient's autonomic health over time, a coach working with athletes on recovery and readiness, or an individual who wants to use HRV data to make smarter decisions about training, sleep, and stress, Optimal HRV gives you the tools to do that well. Accurate measurement, meaningful interpretation, actionable insights grounded in the science we talk about on this show every week. Head to optimalhrv.com to learn more and get started. And now, back to the research. We're now moving into a study that sits at a genuinely exciting frontier, the intersection of HRV measurement technology, nonlinear signal analysis, and artificial intelligence applied to one of the most underdiagnosed conditions in global medicine. Obstructive sleep apnea is a sleep disorder characterized by repeated episodes of upper airway collapse during sleep, resulting in interrupted breathing, oxygen desaturation, and fragmented sleep architecture. Its clinical consequences are serious and well documented: elevated risk of hypertension, cardiovascular disease, including stroke and sudden cardiac death, type 2 diabetes, excessive daytime sleepiness, and impaired cognitive function. The scale of the problem is staggering. It's approximately 425 million adults worldwide are estimated to have moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea, and yet in the United States alone, roughly 82% of men and 93% of women with the condition remain undiagnosed. This is not a rare disease. It is a massively prevalent condition, hiding in plain sight. The diagnostic gold standard for obstructive sleep apnea is polysomnography, a comprehensive multi-channel laboratory-based overnight sleep study that simultaneously monitors brain activity via electroencephalography, eye movements, muscle activity, heart rhythm, airflow, respiratory effort, and oxygen saturation. Polysomnography is highly accurate. It is also expensive, inconvenient, logistically demanding, and entirely impractical for large-scale population screening. Patients must spend a night in a sleep laboratory attached to dozens of sensors, an environment that itself disrupts the very sleep behavior you're trying to measure. Home sleep apnea testing has emerged as a more accessible alternative. These devices monitor a subset of physiological signals, typically airflow, respiratory effort, and oxygen saturation, and can be used by patients in their own beds. They're more convenient and considerably less expensive, but they have their own accuracy limitations and are generally considered most appropriate for patients who are already suspected to be at high risk. The question this third study asks is, can we do even better with an even simpler device by extracting more information from the cardiac signal alone? Specifically, can a small chest-worn patch that records only the electrocardiogram, combined with an artificial intelligence algorithm that analyzes the full depth of HRV information embedded in that signal, accurately screen for obstructive sleep apnea to be clinically useful? This study was published in Nature and Science of Sleep and is titled Patch Type Heart Rate Variability Analysis with Artificial Intelligence for Detection of Obstructive Sleep Apnea. The authors are Yingxiu Xu, Yucheng Lin, Yuan Kuo, Chenghan Cho, Meichun Cho, Yi Chang, Ofer Jacobowitz, Chia Mo Lin, Shi Chia Lo, Terry B. J. Kuo, and Cheryl C. H. Yang. The device at the center of this study is a patch type HRV analyzer developed by the senior authors Terry B. J. Kuo and Cheryl C. H. Yang at National Yangming Xiaotung University. It is roughly 5 centimeters by 3 centimeters, lightweight and worn adhered to the chest. It simultaneously records electrocardiogram signals and data from a 3-axis accelerometer, can record continuously for up to 24 hours, and transmits data via Bluetooth. The device is formally certified as a medical device. This is not a consumer wearable repurposed for research. It is a purpose-built clinical tool. The study enrolled 277 adults who presented with self or family observed snoring. All participants simultaneously underwent home sleep apnea testing using the ApneaLink device, a validated home testing system that measures airflow, respiratory effort, oxygen saturation, heart rate, and sleep posture, while also wearing the HRV patch overnight. This parallel data collection enabled the researchers to use home sleep apnea testing results as the reference standard while evaluating what the HRV patch alone could detect. However, home-based testing comes with a real-world complication that the authors handle transparently. Not everyone's data was usable. Improper device placement, incomplete overnight recordings, poor signal quality, and timing mismatches between the two devices led to a 2-stage data quality control process. After applying strict exclusion criteria, including recordings with electrocardiogram coverage of less than half the sleep period, erroneous beat intervals accounting for half or more of the sleep time, persistent arrhythmias, or timing discrepancies exceeding 30 minutes between the two devices. The final analyzable sample comprised 86 participants. Starting at 277 and arriving at 86 represents substantial attrition, and it is worth pausing to consider. This is not a failure of the device. It reflects the reality of home-based physiological monitoring, where compliance and data quality cannot be controlled as they can in a laboratory. From the 86 usable recordings, the team extracted an extensive feature set. From the RR interval time series alone, they derived time domain measures, including the mean of normal to normal intervals, the standard deviation of normal to normal intervals, and the root mean square of successive differences. Frequency domain measures included total power, very low frequency power, high frequency power, and the low frequency to high frequency ratio. And crucially, they also extracted nonlinear measures, multi-scale entropy, detrended fluctuation analysis, spectral entropy, spectral skewness and kurtosis, and probability density functions. They additionally extracted the amplitude of the RS wave of the electrocardiogram, the height difference between the R peak and the S wave, which fluctuates with respiratory effort and carries information about the mechanical breathing cycle embedded in the cardiac signal. Time series values across the night were summarized using median standard deviation and percentile measures, ultimately producing 375 HRV-related indices per participant. Three predictive models were then developed and evaluated using leave-one-out cross-validation, a rigorous approach that, given a sample of 86, trains the model on 85 participants and tests it on the one held out, repeating this process 86 times. This maximizes the use of available data while generating genuinely unbiased predictions. Model 1 used only basic demographic features: age, height, weight, and body mass index. It achieved an accuracy of 73% for moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea, defined as an apnea-hypopnea index of 15 or more events per hour. This is a useful baseline. It tells us how much discriminative information is embedded in simple demographics alone. Model 2 added 40 HRV parameters from the patch device, the standard time, and frequency domain measures. Accuracy for moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea did not improve markedly over demographics alone with this model, reaching 68%. Model 3 was where the advance occurred. This model incorporated all 375 parameters, the full suite of time domain, frequency domain, nonlinear, and electrocardiogram amplitude features, and applied stepwise variable selection within each cross-validation fold to identify the four most predictive features while preventing overfitting. Model 3 achieved an accuracy of 81.4% for moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea, with a sensitivity of 84%, a specificity of 79%, and an area under the receiver operating characteristic curve of 0.81. For context, this outperforms demographic-based screening at 73% and a previous iteration of the same group's patch-based screening that used the device combined with a tri-axial accelerometer, which had achieved approximately 70.6%. The four features that compose the best predictive model, which the authors named the cardiovascular hypopnea index, were the median kurtosis of the RS amplitude, which reflects the distribution shape of the respiratory-driven cardiac signal, the median heart rate modulation rate, which captures the degree of beat-to-beat fluctuation, 65th percentile of very low frequency power across the night, capturing slow regulatory processes, including sympathetic and thermoregulatory activity, and the median heart rate complexity measured by entropy, which quantifies the nonlinear dynamics of the RR interval series and reflects the richness of autonomic regulation. Higher complexity is associated with better autonomic regulation. Reduced complexity is associated with autonomic rigidity, cardiovascular risk, and, as this study suggests, obstructive sleep apnea. The physiological logic connecting these features to obstructive sleep apnea is worth unpacking. Each apnea episode produces a characteristic cardiac signature. Heart rate decelerates during the obstructed breath, then accelerates sharply as breathing resumes. This cyclical variation imposes a specific pattern on the RR interval time series that linear HRV measures partially capture, but nonlinear measures may detect more sensitively. The addition of RS amplitude information adds a proxy for respiratory effort directly extracted from the cardiac waveform. The chest wall displacement that accompanies each breath modulates the electrical axis of the heart, producing subtle amplitude changes that are visible in the electrocardiogram if you know how to look for them. The key insight of this study is that the information needed to screen for obstructive sleep apnea may be richly encoded in the cardiac signal, but accessing it requires both the right feature set and the right analytical approach. Traditional HRV analysis using a handful of standard time domain and frequency domain measures, Model 2, didn't get you there. Combining nonlinear features, amplitude data, and artificial intelligence did. Now, the limitations are real, and the authors are honest about them. The sample size of 86 is small, particularly for a machine learning study where model overfitting is a genuine risk. The leave-one-out cross-validation methodology mitigates this, but external validation in an independent cohort is the essential next step before this approach can be considered clinically reliable. The study was conducted at a single center in Taiwan, and the patient population, adults presenting to a sleep medicine clinic with snoring, is a selected sample. Generalizability to other ethnicities, clinical settings, and community-based populations has not been established. The reference standard itself carries limitations. Home sleep apnea testing does not include electroencephalography, and therefore cannot confirm that the patient was actually asleep during the recording. This means that some respiratory events may be misclassified. Apneas occurring during wakefulness are scored as sleep apneas, or light sleep arousals are missed entirely. This is a known limitation of all home sleep testing approaches, and it sets an upper bound on the accuracy of any home-based screening tool against this reference. The high data attrition, from 277 enrolled to 86 analyzable, is also clinically relevant. If this device were deployed in a real-world screening program, a false start rate of nearly 70% due to data quality issues would pose a serious operational challenge. The authors note that improved patient education on device placement and operation could reduce this, but this remains a limitation that needs to be addressed in future studies. What this study demonstrates within those constraints is that a single-channel wearable cardiac monitor combined with comprehensive HRV analysis and artificial intelligence can achieve clinically meaningful screening accuracy for moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea, outperforming both demographic models and simpler cardiac monitoring approaches. The Cardiovascular Hypopnea Index framework specifically, with its integration of nonlinear complexity measures and amplitude-derived respiratory proxies, represents a genuine methodological advance over previous single-feature approaches, such as cyclic variation in heart rate or cardiopulmonary coupling. For sleep medicine clinicians, this is a tool to watch. For HRV researchers and practitioners, it is a compelling demonstration of how much more information is embedded in the cardiac signal than standard analysis extracts, and how artificial intelligence, applied carefully and validated rigorously, can begin to unlock that information. The fourth and final study today takes us into territory that might seem, at first glance, distant from the world of autonomic science. Benign prostatic hyperplasia, the non-cancerous, age-related enlargement of the prostate gland that affects the majority of men over 60 and up to 80% of men over 70, is typically framed as a urological problem. Its symptoms are urological: difficulty initiating urination, weak stream, urgency, nocturia, and incomplete bladder emptying. Its treatments are urological: alpha-1 adrenergic receptor blockers to relax smooth muscle, or surgical resection to physically remove the obstructing tissue. The autonomic nervous system, if mentioned at all, tends to appear only as the explanation for why alpha blockers work. But this framing misses something. The lower urinary tract is heavily innervated by both sympathetic and parasympathetic fibers. The normal filling and voiding cycle is a precisely orchestrated autonomic process. The sympathetic system mediates bladder filling by relaxing the detrusor muscle and contracting the bladder neck, while the parasympathetic system drives voiding by contracting the detrusor and relaxing the outlet. When bladder outlet obstruction is present, the normal voiding cycle is disrupted. The bladder wall hypertrophies in response to the chronically increased workload. Voiding becomes incomplete, residual urine accumulates, and the bladder never fully empties. This chronic state of obstructed, incomplete voiding likely sustains afferent neural signaling, a continuous barrage of sensory information traveling from the bladder to the spinal cord and brain, conveying discomfort, urgency, and incomplete voiding. That afferent barrage may dysregulate autonomic tone, not just locally, but systemically. If sympathetic overactivation is part of the physiological response to a chronically dysfunctional organ, then the whole body autonomic signature, as reflected in reduced HRV, may be a systemic marker of a local urological problem. And if that is true, then relieving the obstruction should restore autonomic balance. And HRV should be sensitive enough to detect that restoration. That is the central hypothesis of this study. This study was published in Life and is titled Uroselective Alpha-1, A Blockade versus Surgical Deobstruction: Differential Associations with Heart Rate Variability Restoration and Symptom Relief in Benign Prostatic Hyperplasia with Bladder Outlet Obstruction. The authors are Kuan Yu Chen, Yu Hui Huang, Yunsheng Chen, Minhsin Yang, Kaixiang Chen, Chiejui Chen, Chengju Ho, Chi Kai Ping, and Sungling Chen. This was a prospective non-randomized observational cohort study reported in accordance with the Strengthening the Reporting of Observational Studies in Epidemiology guidelines. Participants were recruited from the urology department at Cheongshan Medical University Hospital over a three-year period. Treatment allocation followed standard shared clinical decision-making. Patients with an international prostate symptom score at or above 15, prostate volume at or above 50 milliliters, or intolerance to long-term medication were offered transurethral resection of the prostate. Others received tamsulosin at 0.4 milligrams once daily. The study analyzed data from 242 men who underwent transurethral resection of the prostate and 210 men who received tamsulosin. HRV was assessed using 24-hour Holter monitoring at baseline and at exactly 12 weeks post-intervention. The primary HRV outcome was the standard deviation of normal to normal intervals. Secondary outcomes included the low to high frequency ratio, total power, and very low frequency power. Urinary symptom severity was assessed using the International Prostate Symptom Score. Propensity score matching was used to create balanced comparison groups, controlling for age, prostate volume, international prostate symptom score, and baseline standard deviation of normal to normal intervals. The results are striking in their directionality and magnitude. After transurethral resection of the prostate, the standard deviation of normal to normal intervals increased by approximately 14.7 milliseconds, a relative increase of about 40%, from approximately 37 milliseconds at baseline to approximately 52 milliseconds at 12 weeks. The low to high frequency ratio decreased by approximately 55%, reflecting a substantial shift away from sympathetic dominance. Total power increased by 95%, very nearly doubling, and very low frequency power increased by approximately 85%. Effect sizes were large. Cohen's D of 1.12 for total power and 1.01 for very low frequency power. In the tamsulosin group, improvements were also statistically significant, but considerably smaller in magnitude. The standard deviation of normal to normal intervals increased by approximately 6.7 milliseconds, or 18%. The low to high frequency ratio decreased by only 8%. Total power increased by 39%, and very low frequency power by 35%. The intergroup differences were statistically significant in an analysis of covariance, with partial ETA squared values ranging from 0.12 to 0.22, indicating moderate to large effect sizes attributable to the group factor. On the symptom side, transurethral resection of the prostate produced a reduction of approximately 10.2 points on the International Prostate Symptom Score, compared to 5.3 points for tamsulosin. Both reductions were statistically significant, but the surgical benefit was nearly twice as large. Voiding subscores improved more in the transurethral resection of the prostate group, and quality of life index improvements were also greater. In multivariate regression analysis, a change in the standard deviation of normal to normal intervals was independently associated with improvement in International Prostate Symptom Score, with a standardized beta coefficient of minus 0.42, accounting for 28% of the variance in symptom improvement after controlling for age and prostate volume. Correlations between HRV changes and symptom changes were moderate to strong in the transurethral resection of the prostate group and weaker but still significant in the tamsulosin group. Propensity score matched analysis confirmed these findings. In 210 matched pairs with balanced baselines, standardized mean differences below 0.1 for all matching variables, the transurethral resection of the prostate group maintained greater HRV improvement and symptom reduction. What are we to make of this? The greater HRV restoration after transurethral resection of the prostate than after tamsulosin is consistent with the hypothesis that surgical relief of physical obstruction addresses autonomic dysregulation more completely than pharmacological relaxation of smooth muscle tone. Tamsulosin blocks alpha-1A adrenergic receptors in the prostate and bladder neck, reducing outflow resistance and improving urinary flow, but it does not remove the obstructing tissue. The prostate is still enlarged, the bladder wall is still hypertrophied, and the afferent signaling from a still obstructed, still dysfunctional bladder presumably continues at some level. Transurethral resection of the prostate removes the obstructing tissue entirely. The functional obstruction is gone, the bladder can empty completely, and the afferent barrage that was driving sympathetic overactivation can, in principle, cease. The regression finding, that the standard deviation of normal to normal intervals changes predicted symptom improvement independently, is harder to interpret causally but conceptually interesting. The authors also note an intriguing baseline observation. The transurethral resection of the prostate group, despite having more severe symptoms, paradoxically had a lower baseline low frequency to high frequency ratio than the tamsulosin group. The authors interpret this as evidence of autonomic blunting and fatigue in advanced disease, in which prolonged sympathetic overdrive may lead to receptor desensitization and reduced overall variability, as reflected in a lower standard deviation of normal to normal intervals and total power despite the more severe clinical picture. This pattern has parallels in other chronic stress states, including heart failure. The limitations are real, and the authors are admirably clear about them. This is an observational study. Propensity score matching improves comparability, but does not eliminate confounding from unmeasured variables. Physical activity level, sleep quality, duration of benign prostatic hyperplasia symptoms, alcohol intake, and autonomic neuropathy were not recorded and represent acknowledged limitations. The 12-week follow-up window tells us about early post-intervention changes, but nothing about durability. Longer-term data at 6 and 12 months are needed to confirm that these HRV improvements persist. The secondary HRV parameters, the low-frequency to high-frequency ratio, total power, and very low-frequency power, had Benjamin Hochberg corrected p-values above 0.05 for some comparisons in the transurethral resection of the prostate group, indicating that their robustness is less than that of the primary standard deviation of normal-to-normal interval results. The study also exclusively used standard transurethral resection of the prostate and did not include newer minimally invasive surgical options, so we cannot extrapolate these findings to those procedures. And the authors rightly note that the placebo effect of surgery, the well-documented tendency for surgical patients to report greater subjective improvements due to the psychological impact of the procedure, may have inflated the International Prostate Symptom Score delta in the transurethral resection of the prostate group, even if the objective HRV changes are less susceptible to this bias. What this study does well is ask a question that the urology and autonomic communities should probably be asking much more often. Benign prostatic hyperplasia is framed almost exclusively as a voiding problem. This paper makes a compelling case that it is also an autonomic stress condition, one whose systemic effects can be detected, tracked, and partially restored using HRV. For clinicians working at the intersection of urology and cardiovascular medicine, and for researchers interested in visceral obstruction and autonomic regulation more broadly, this paper offers a genuinely novel framework. The authors call for long-term randomized trials, and that call is entirely appropriate. Four studies, four clinical domains, and yet when you step back and look at them together, what's striking is not their differences, but their convergences. The most obvious convergence is the one that defines the show. All four studies used HRV in one form or another as a primary outcome measure, and all four found that HRV responded meaningfully to the conditions or interventions they were studying. A structured review found consistent HRV shifts in acupuncture research. An exercise study found HRV improved over a 6-week treadmill program. An artificial intelligence study extracted enough information from overnight HRV to screen for a major sleep disorder with clinically meaningful accuracy. An observational study found that treating urological obstruction restores HRV in proportion to the completeness of that treatment. Three entirely different intervention types, one diagnostic application, all converging on the same instrument. The second convergence is directional. Wherever an intervention produced benefit, whether it was a needle, a treadmill, or a surgical resectoscope, the HRV change pointed in the same direction. More parasympathetic, less sympathetic, more variable, more complex. High-frequency HRV improved or was targeted across all four studies. That consistent directional signal on toward vagal upregulation and away from sympathetic dominance, none is not accidental. It reflects a real aspect of physiological health from the perspective of the autonomic system. The third convergence is technological. Three of the four studies used wearable or ambulatory HRV measurement, a patch, a Holter monitor, or a clinical HRV device. And the sleep apnea study explicitly stated that the diagnostic information is already in the cardiac signal. The challenge is extracting it with sufficient analytical sophistication. This is a theme that will only become more prominent as wearable technology matures. The question is no longer whether we can measure the cardiac signal at home, but whether we are analyzing everything that signal contains. The fourth convergence, and this one is a caution, is that all four studies sit at the early end of the evidence spectrum. The acupuncture review calls for prospective validation. The treadmill study needs a randomized controlled trial. The sleep apnea study needs external validation in larger, more diverse populations. And the benign prostatic hyperplasia study needs randomized long-term follow-up. We are in the interesting and somewhat uncomfortable place that characterizes productive scientific frontiers. The signals are compelling, the mechanisms are plausible, and the definitive evidence is still being gathered. If I had to identify the single most important takeaway from this episode, it would be this. HRV is proving to be a remarkably sensitive and versatile instrument for detecting autonomic consequences and autonomic benefits that span virtually every organ system and every clinical specialty, acupuncture, exercise, sleep medicine, urology. The autonomic nervous system turns out to be relevant in all of them, and HRV turns out to be the right tool to measure it. That expanding frontier is exactly what this show will continue to follow. Thank you for listening to This Week in HRV. If you found this episode valuable, please share it with a colleague, a clinician, a coach, or anyone who works with the nervous system in any capacity. Leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Check the show notes for direct links to all four studies. We'll be back next week with more research, more mechanisms, and more signal in the noise. Take care of your nervous system. It's taking care of you.